Welcome to the PRI Review, brought to you by the Population Research Institute. I'm your host, Christopher Mannion. PRI President Steve Mosier writes about China's House of Cards. For 2,000 years, the Chinese Empire has sought to overawe visiting barbarians with the magnificence of the imperial court. As Air Force One landed at the dragon-shaped Beijing International Airport, President Trump was treated to a skyline that didn't exist until a few years ago. Most of Beijing's old residential neighborhoods, called Hutong, were deliberately destroyed in the frenzied build-out that preceded the 2008 Olympics. They have been replaced by stadiums like the Bird's Nest, which actually resembles a giant's bird's nest, and by high-rise office buildings. Then there are the Leaning Towers, the headquarters of China Central Television, the Beijing regime's primary propaganda outfit. The Leaning Towers consist of two towers leaning at different angles, joined 36 stories up by a 250-foot L-shaped overhang. Unlike the Leaning Tower of Pisa, which acquired its tilt naturally, the awkward structure was designed to look like it is falling over. As such, it could stand as a metaphor for the reckless building boom that has plunged China into a level of debt that few nations have ever recovered from. Without going through a devastating economic meltdown, that is. For the past 20 years, China has kept roughly half the world's cranes busy, turning wheat fields and peasant huts all over China into skyscrapers. For someone like myself, says Steve, who first visited China in 1979, the transformation is almost miraculous. The luster begins to fade when you realize that the land was stolen by rapacious communist officials from poor workers and peasants who had lived in these huts and farmed these lands for centuries. It disappears entirely when you understand that many of the new apartment and office buildings are often nearly devoid of tenants. This means that the soft construction loans that were so generously doled out by the party's managers of state-owned banks to their party comrades who run construction companies will never be paid back. China's Xi Jinping should have asked Donald Trump what happens when you overbuild. Instead, back at the 2012 Party Congress, the newly installed Party Supremo announced that he intended to double the size of the economy by 2020. The regime's central planners swiftly calculated that this required an annual GDP growth of 6.5% and ordered everyone to fall in line. In order to hit this target, the state has been recklessly printing money and rolling over debt ever since. As a result of these practices, the country's debt has been ballooning in recent years. The Institute of International Finance estimates that China's total debt surpassed 304% of GDP as of May 2017. Knowing something about Chinese accounting practices, I would guess that even this startling number is a gross underestimate. Consider that most Chinese businesses keep three sets of books. The first two are cooked, one to convince the government that the company owes no taxes, the other to mislead business partners, especially foreign partners, that it is barely turning a profit. The only accurate accounting of revenues and expenses is to be found in the third set, which the proprietor keeps carefully hidden away from prying eyes. It's a safe bet that many local, city, and provincial governments are fudging the numbers or keeping bad loans off the books entirely in the accounting they send up the chain of command to Beijing. The China that Xi Jinping showcased to the American president thus contains lots of beautiful new buildings and cranes that are busily constructing even more. The builder in Donald Trump will probably be impressed by all the new construction, but the businessman may question whether such an overheated economy can long survive. Trump knows that the Chinese economy is essentially derivative. It feeds parasitically off of the U.S. consumer economy, soaking up $500 billion a year in foreign currency, which it then uses to prop up its own failing state-owned enterprises. He also knows, thanks in part to Peter Navarro, about all the dizzying array of illegal export subsidies, currency manipulation, intellectual property theft, sweatshop labor, and pollution havens that China has used to seize market share from both Europe and North America. Finally, he knows that America's ruling class, that loose coalition of globalists and progressives also known as the Washington Establishment, literally sold out America when it allowed China to join the World Trade Organization. As Lenin might have said, the establishment sold China the rope that it is using to hang us. But if the establishment made the classic capitalist blunder, Comrade Z may have made the classic communist one. Like all good communists, Z apparently believes that he can simply command the economy to grow, and grow it will. Acting on the belief that the economy was his to command, the late Chairman Mao nearly destroyed it. He launched the Great Leap Forward in the late 50s, ordered his people into communes, and commanded them to catch up to Great Britain and steel production in 3 years. Xi Jinping, acting out of the same belief, has set the Chinese economy on a similarly dangerous course. He is so bent on surpassing the United States and achieving his China dream of world hegemony that he ordered the Chinese economy to double in size in 8 years. Mao's blunder led to a massive famine costing 45 million lives. Xi's blunder has led to a debt bubble so massive that it may turn China's beautiful new facade of modernity into nothing more than a world-class Potemkin village. Last year, for the first time in our nation's history, the American people elected as a president someone with no experience in government. Trump has never been a senator, a congressman, or a governor, nor even a cabinet secretary or a general. What he does bring to the table is the acumen of an entrepreneur who has spent his life in construction and finance. If anyone understands that China is sitting on a mammoth debt bubble of its own making, it is Donald Trump. The president needs to make clear to Xi that he holds a very, very sharp pen. Then he needs to begin to do what he does best, negotiate in earnest. Now, right now, Steve's important new book, Bully of Asia, is coming off the presses at Regnery Publishers as we speak. Here's your chance to get that landmark book and help PRI as well. Steve is an internationally recognized authority on China. He is also the author of numerous books on China, among them Broken Earth, The Rural Chinese, A Mother's Ordeal, One Woman's Fight Against China's One-Child Policy, and Hegemon, China's Plan to Dominate Asia and the World. He's written hundreds of scholarly articles, editorials, and opinion pieces. This book, The Bully of Asia, is indispensable to understanding America's greatest foreign policy challenge today. The signs are everywhere. China unilaterally claims the entire South China Sea as sovereign territory, then builds artificial islands to bolster that claim. It suddenly activates an air defense identification zone over the East China Sea, and threatens to down any aircraft that does not report its position. It builds roads into Indian territory, then redraws the maps to show that it is actually Chinese territory. China is still forcibly aborting millions of its children, leaving tens of millions of Chinese men without spouses, ripe for the military conquest of countries where women might be more plentiful. The People's Republic under President Xi Jinping is quickly becoming the bully of Asia. Here's your chance to learn more about the threat China poses to global security. With your donation of $20 or more to the Population Research Institute, we'll send you a copy of Bully of Asia as our way to thank you in helping to end population control around the world. Just go to our website, pop.org, and click on the special offer to get your copy of Bully of Asia today. This is PRI Review from pop.org. We'll be right back. Do you want to win pro-life legislative and political battles? For years, PRI has been helping pro-life leaders on the ground around the world to win legislative and political battles in order to protect the lives of the unborn. And now we're asking for your help so we can continue this vital work. Let me tell you more. In a number of countries around the world, there are still pro-life laws on the books. But the Planned Parenthood Abortion Liberales Malthusians are out there to get rid of those laws. Nearly 5 years ago, the Pontifical Council on the Family asked PRI to be the main organization to help the pro-life movements around the world to be more effective. In response to the Vatican's request, we created our Pro-Life Victory Seminars and our Pro-Life Strategy Guide. The seminars are grueling, demanding 12 to 14-hour intense working sessions. Only the most proven and successful leaders are invited to speak. Only the best and the most committed activists are invited to attend. To date, we have conducted 60 such sessions in 18 countries. We have trained more than 1,700 people who are serious about protecting the unborn in their respective countries. They have won some victories, but I'm not going to tell you about those because I don't want to put a target on the back of those leaders. I'm not going to tell you the names of their countries either because I don't want to make it even harder for them to do their work. But here's a hint. Most, though not all, have Spanish as their native tongue. It's no secret that south of our border, pro-abortionists are zeroing in on the existing pro-life laws in that part of the world. I cannot tell you the battle stories, although there are many, without endangering the victories of the leaders. I must ask you to take my word that some battles in some countries could not have been won without the training and support received from PRI. What kind of training am I talking about? Everywhere in the world, defenders of life need everything: strategic thinking skills, campaign skills, legislative skills, lobbying skills, to protect their pro-life laws and to stop pro-death initiatives. Around the world, we found that the biggest thing lacking is know-how. By that, I mean political sophistication. Here in America, we've been fighting pro-life battles for almost 50 years, and while we haven't won definitively, we have learned a lot about how to fight, as well as how not to fight. One of the most important tools of our pro-life victory training is the manual that the trainees get to take home with them, the Pro-Life Strategy Guide, the guide to winning pro-life battles. Think of it as a field guide to activism. The guide is a compendium of know-how. It is 200 pages of distilled experience and wisdom, with step-by-step instructions about how to advance our issue in a representative landscape. Here's a small sampling of the know-how delivered in these training sessions. How to raise money, how to lobby legislators, how to write powerful pro-life advertising, how to effectively appear on TV and radio, how to enlist volunteers, how to get out the vote, and how to successfully debate pro-abortionists. All this and much, much more is covered in the training program and reinforced in the training guide. The first edition came out in 2012, but we are all out of them now. They have all been put in the hands of able pro-life leaders. So today we have had it revised and updated by two of the best and most successful activists in the Spanish-speaking world. Today the new PRI, Pro-Life Strategy Guide, the guide to winning pro-life battles, is ready to go to press. This is where you come in. Will you help us get it into the hands of the people who need it? It's in Spanish right now, and that's as it should be, because we distribute it throughout the Spanish-speaking world. The Vatican wants this field manual in every diocese in the world. Will you help me to fulfill that request? PRI has ordered 10,000 copies of the guide to be printed, enough for every student who will attend our training sessions for the next several years, along with all the actively pro-life bishops around the world. Just the printing alone will cost $50,000. The whole International Victory Training Program costs another $50,000, and that is in addition to the field guide. But right now we want to get those guides printed. So I turn to you because I know you understand its value. The cost comes out to about $5 per book, which is not very much considering the impact it can have and the lives it can save. With your tax-deductible gift of $50, PRI can put this guide into the hands of 10 in-country pro-life leaders. With a gift of $100, we can make sure that 10 friendly bishops get a copy to guide their strategic thinking in the protection of life. No gift is too small. If you can only spare $5, please send it today. Unborn babies around the world will be safer because of your sacrifice today. Can we count on you to help PRI to continue to train and empower the pro-life movement around the world? On behalf of all those fighting to preserve pro-life laws around the world, thank you. Here's your weekly briefing from the Population Research Institute at pop.org. Abortion providers sue Texas for banning dismemberment abortion. Brought to you by Jonathan Abamonte. A Texas law banning a gruesome and inhumane abortion procedure known as dilation and evacuation, D&E, is being challenged in federal court. This past Thursday, U.S. District Judge Lee Yackel of the United States District Court for the Western District of Texas, Austin Division, opened a trial on the state's D&E ban. D&E, better known as dismemberment abortion, is one of the most brutal abortion procedures legally permitted in the United States. The procedure involves tearing apart the unborn child limb by limb, causing the child to bleed to death. The baby is removed in pieces, piece by piece, from the uterus using forceps or vacuum aspiration. Afterwards, the woman's uterus is scraped with a long metal curette to remove any remnants of the baby or the placenta left in the womb. Texas Attorney General Ken Paxton, a valiant defender of life, has vowed to defend the state's dismemberment abortion ban in federal court. "I will always fight to protect the basic human rights and dignity of the unborn," Attorney General Ken Paxton told PRI. "The Texas legislature," he continued, "through the passage of Senate Bill 8, took reasonable steps to prohibit the live dismemberment of babies still in the womb, a brutal, gruesome, and inhumane procedure that involves an abortionist tearing apart a fully formed child limb by limb. It's time for the American people fully to understand the horrific practices occurring in our country," end quote. This past June, Texas Governor Greg Abbott signed into law Senate Bill 8, SB 8, a sweeping pro-life law banning dismemberment abortion in the state. SB 8 also prohibited the sale of fetal body parts and required abortion facilities to at least treat the remains of aborted babies with the minimum of respect by burying or cremating them. In August, Judge Yackel placed a temporary restraining order on the Texas dismemberment ban, preventing the law from going into effect. In September, Yackel extended the hold on SB 8 until November the 22nd. Federal and state courts elsewhere have also recently overturned or have placed holds on dismemberment abortion bans in other states. Last week, U.S. District Judge Myron Thompson of the Middle District of Alabama struck down Alabama's dismemberment abortion ban, claiming the law was unconstitutional. Courts have also placed temporary or permanent injunctions on dismemberment bans in Arkansas, Kansas, Louisiana, and Oklahoma. Dismemberment laws in Mississippi and West Virginia have remained unchallenged. The Kansas Supreme Court is currently hearing a case that will determine the fate of Kansas's dismemberment abortion ban. The Kansas Unborn Child Protection from Dismemberment Abortion Act was signed into law in 2015 by pro-life Kansas Governor Sam Brownback. Due to a legal challenge, the law never went into effect. The Kansas Supreme Court is expected to hand down a final decision sometime later this week. While pro-abortion advocates in Texas and other states have challenged dismemberment laws through federal courts, the Kansas case is being argued through the state court system. A majority of the sitting justices on the Kansas Supreme Court were appointed by pro-abortion former Kansas Governor Kathleen Sebelius, who also served in Obama administration as Secretary of the Department of Health and Human Services. Under Sebelius's leadership, the HHS rolled out and implemented the onerous HHS contraceptive mandate, which triggered the largest cascade of religious liberty lawsuits in U.S. history. As Margo Cleveland, University of Notre Dame professor and former longtime federal appellate law clerk, pointed out in an article last week, the Kansas case could have greater implications for the people of Kansas than the other cases pending in federal courts. While federal law, through the Supreme Court's precedent set out in Roe v. Wade, Planned Parenthood v. Casey, and others, has already long held that women have a so-called fundamental right to abortion, a liberal judgment from the Kansas Supreme Court could create a similar or perhaps worse purported right to abortion in the Kansas State Constitution. While the direct termination of the life of an unborn child is always contrary to the fundamental and inherent right to life for every human being, until Roe v. Wade is overturned, it is all but impossible from a legal perspective, unconditionally, to protect the right to life for the unborn. The state of Texas has maintained that the state has an interest in promoting respect for the dignity of the life of the unborn, by ensuring that, at the very least, the unborn child is not submitted to cruel and inhumane dismemberment procedures. Roe held that the state could not restrict access to abortion prior to viability, except to protect women's health. But Supreme Court decisions in Casey changed that. States are now able to regulate abortion for reasons other than women's health, even prior to viability, just so long as those restrictions do not create an undue burden. In the Texas case, pro-abortion advocates are arguing that banning dismemberment abortion places an undue burden on women's access to abortion. However, the Texas dismemberment abortion ban can only be applied to a limited number of cases. D&E abortions are generally only performed in the second trimester after 15 weeks gestation. D&E abortions consist only a small percentage of the total number of abortions committed in the United States, hardly constituting an undue burden to abortion access. And even though dismemberment abortion is never medically necessary, the Texas dismemberment ban even carves out an exemption for what is called a medical emergency. Most countries worldwide set gestational limits on abortion prior to 15 weeks. Even countries that have legalized abortion place significant term limits on the procedure. It is difficult to imagine that laws in Western European countries such as France, Belgium, Germany, Spain, and Italy, which prohibit abortion on demand after 14 weeks gestation or less, constitute an undue burden on abortion access. After all, each of these Western European countries have far lower maternal mortality rates than the United States. And as a recent Marist poll has shown, an overwhelming majority of Americans are in favor of restricting abortion to the first trimester or to cases of rape, incest, and life of the mother. It is difficult to believe that abortion restrictions that comport with term limits that nearly 80% of Americans agree with constitute an undue burden. The state further has a compelling interest in ensuring that human life, human dignity, and bodily integrity are protected by law. The state has the right, and in fact the duty, to ensure that unborn children, who are guilty of no wrong, are afforded the same constitutional legal protection afforded to criminals who are rightly protected from the imposition of cruel and unusual punishments. The plaintiffs suing the state of Texas claim that D&E is the only safe, studied, or medically appropriate procedure for second trimester abortions, despite the fact that abortion, particularly dismemberment, is never safe or medically appropriate for the unborn child. D&E further carries health risks for the mother, including, in some cases, uterine perforation and excess blood loss, not to mention the well-documented risks abortion poses to women's physical, emotional, and psychological health in general, particularly during the second semester. As the state of Texas points out, several abortion procedures which do not dismember the unborn child while still alive are still legal, including fetal injection of intracardiac potassium chloride, transabdominal injection of digoxin, and cutting of the umbilical cord. And as plaintiffs themselves admit, abortionists could simply induce the labor instead of dismembering the unborn child. According to the plaintiffs, potassium chloride and digoxin are not indicated for abortion. Texas state law prohibits the off-label use of drugs to procure an abortion. Yet evidence purportedly obtained by the state of Texas found that abortion providers in Texas already used digoxin to abort unborn babies prior to initiating D&E. So, if D&E is never medically necessary, if a ban on D&E does not constitute an undue burden on abortion access, and if a ban on D&E does not even eliminate the possibility of a second trimester abortion, what could possibly be the motivation for abortion providers like Planned Parenthood to fight so hard for keeping baby dismemberment legal? Perhaps the real reason has something to do with the method's effectiveness. At 15 weeks gestation, dismemberment abortion is the cheapest option and the only surefire way to ensure that the baby comes out dead. Abortionists don't want to be bothered with lawsuits for botched abortions or criminal investigations into cases of infanticide. Instead, they'd rather tear tiny unborn babies apart limb by limb. Their depravity knows no bounds. This has been your weekly briefing from the Population Research Institute. Thanks for listening. By now, we all know that Planned Parenthood is accused in the United States of allegedly violating the law by, among other atrocities, selling baby body parts. But what you might not realize is that Planned Parenthood's affiliates, Planned Parenthood Federation of America, PPFA, and International Planned Parenthood Federation, IPPF, are still getting away with murder overseas. Around the world, and especially in Latin America, the baby-killing giant shades the truth about its abortion-related activities. It runs roughshod over local anti-abortion laws and violates local pro-life sentiment, all with seeming impunity. But not anymore. With your tax-deductible gift, PRI will throw the book at the abortion giants overseas, just as pro-life groups are doing here at home. Did you know that PPFA spends about $38 million a year lobbying to legalize abortion in countries around the world? If they're successful, they can kill as many, if not more, babies overseas as they do in the United States. But there's a hitch. Because abortion remains illegal in most Latin American countries, neither IPPF nor PPFA is eligible for government funding for abortion-related activities as they are in the United States. So PPFA, IPPF, gets around it as only they know how to do, by lying. With a wink and a nod, they disguise the programs they are funding as, quote, education or health programs, women's right, human rights protection or promotion, and anti-discrimination initiatives aimed at protecting vulnerable groups such as women or LGBTs, that means lesbian, gay, bisexual, and transgender, end quote. Catholic bishops throughout Africa and Latin America complain about this. They call it ideological imperialism, but their voices are not heard in Congress because America's bishops depend on billions in government funding for their own charities. They don't want to bite the political hand that feeds them. Now, PRI receives no government funding, so we aren't hampered by a golden handcuff. That's why your tax-deductible gift to PRI is so important today. As the lead group investigating Planned Parenthood's activities overseas, PRI's Latin American office has uncovered PPFA's thinly disguised efforts to undermine pro-life laws and legitimate abortion on demand. But we've only found the tip of the iceberg, and there is more work to be done, work that we can't do alone. Your tax-deductible gift will help PRI hire a seasoned pro-life legal team to help us expose, investigate, and prosecute Planned Parenthood's affiliates everywhere they prey on women, especially overseas. Together, we'll expose, investigate, and prosecute PPFA and IPPF everywhere it tries to hide the truth. This two-prong attack, complementing the hearings taking place in Washington, will force Planned Parenthood to fight on two fronts. What better way to strike a blow against the real Planned Parenthood, the one we saw in all those horrific videos, than to come at them here and abroad? So please make a tax-deductible gift to support this and all of PRI's baby-saving efforts around the world. Yes, they're powerful. Yes, they're big. But remember, David and Goliath. The bigger they are, the harder they fall. After the recent fatal attack by a terrorist who mowed down kids and pedestrians with a rental truck in New York City, New York Governor Andrew Cuomo made a startling admission. He actually uttered the forbidden words radical Islam. He further revealed that the terrorist had been radicalized not in his home of Uzbekistan, but only after his arrival in the United States. Not surprisingly, NBC News offered this headline in reporting the massacre. Muslim Americans again brace for backlash after New York attack. Well, not to be outdone, Representative Gerald Nadler, Democrat of New York City, bellowed tired banalities on MSNBC, wrapping up with his solution. New York should fight terrorism, and I'm not kidding, by strengthening regulation of truck rentals. Bishop Timothy Cardinal Dolan responded to the attacks by saying that we must, and I quote, work towards greater respect and understanding among all people so that heinous and evil acts like this become a thing of the past, end quote. Consider, the terrorist, whom I will not dignify with a name, shouted Allahu Akbar as he careened on his murderous rampage. Understanding, Your Eminence? What is left to understand? Moreover, if there is one salient fact to respect, Raymond Cardinal Burke made that fact perfectly clear. I'm quoting, there's no question that Islam wants to govern the world, he writes in his book, Hope for the World, to unite all things in Christ. There is no place for other religions. As long as Islam has not succeeded in establishing its sovereignty over the nations and over the world. Now, Father James V. Shaw, S.J., a wonderful and marvelous teacher at Georgetown for many years, points out that we have become used to such terror as we uncritically insist on calling it. This getting used to it, however, is why such atrocities continue to happen. The strategy of those who initiate them is to deflect their enemy's attention away from understanding Islam, what it says about itself. Such man-made flare-ups are like hurricanes. One follows another inevitably. No one can halt them. We can only prepare to mop up the next mess, end quote. Well, to mop up correctly, Cardinal Dolan insists we must do so with understanding and respect. If I may apply the words of Father Shaw, the cardinal is indeed Islam's enemy, but his attention has been deflected away from understanding Islam. Father Shaw respects Islam so much that he takes it seriously on its own terms, not from the point of view of vapid, sentimental, happy talk of Catholic versions of Rodney King. Why can't we all just get along? To the believing Muslim, Father Shaul observes, getting along with Islam means surrender. I quote, "Islam is what those who take it most seriously, those who lay down their lives for it, claim that it is," he writes. "The duty of Muslim thinkers and believers in different places and periods of time is to select the best prudential means, be it arms or peace, to achieve a world order subject to the law of Allah. Ultimately, real peace on earth can only exist when everyone in practice submits to Muslim law. Until then, those not under Muslim law are technically at war with Islam, which sees itself involved in a just war against unbelievers of all sorts." End quote. Now, Father Shaul's reflections, which appeared in Crisis magazine in September, reflect his unflappable common sense that he has applied to Islam in the years following the historic Regensburg address of Pope Benedict, another realist. Shaul's article bears the striking title, "Why I Believe in Islam." Now, that's reminiscent of the tireless work of Dr. Fred Schwartz 50 years ago regarding the communist menace. "You can trust the communists," Schwartz insisted at every turn, "to do exactly what their ideology tells them to do." Cardinal Dolan's remark calls to mind the remarks to Congress made by Archbishop Salvatore Cordeleone 2 years ago regarding the death of Kate Steinle. While walking along the docks with her father, Miss Steinle was murdered by a repeatedly deported illegal alien criminal who had sought refuge in San Francisco because it was a sanctuary city. The Archbishop extended his condolences and prayers to the Steinle family, but quickly insisted that we not use her murder as an excuse to apply guilt by association to the millions of criminal illegals already in the country. Undoubtedly, Archbishop Cordeleone would urge us to a greater respect and understanding for illegal aliens, and I add that I'm sure he does this in good faith. At least he is consistent. 2 years after Steinle's murder, he joined his fellow California bishops in supporting the continuation of San Francisco's illegal sanctuary city status, and that has been confirmed by his office. Sometimes the drivel dribbles down to the parish level, alas, to countless parishes. When our own rural parish in Virginia requested the use of our parish hall for a presentation on our bishop's support of Muslim immigration, one Jeff Caruso, who has the peculiar role of diocesan lobbyist and doctrinal expert, inserted himself in the process by forbidding the issue to be discussed on parish grounds, giving this so-called explanation. I'm quoting him exactly. "The singling out of Muslims as a security threat also reflects a bias against one religion that is at odds with the teaching of the church, which views that religion as part of God's plan for salvation," end quote. Well, Allahu Akbar, Mr. Caruso. Let's face it, the magnitude of the magisterial blind spot infecting the American hierarchy and its chancery apparatchiks is simply stunning. When one adds the virtual disappearance of the defense of the church's moral teaching, the affliction approaches the textbook definition of a black hole. Nothing can come out of it. The gravitational field, in this case, ennui, is so strong. True to form, Cardinal Dolan, who yearns for greater respect and understanding of Islam, calmly shrugs when he admits to the Wall Street Journal that he and his fellow bishops haven't taught the fundamental truths of Humanae Vitae for 50 years, even though the faithful are hungry, he says. Hungry for those truths so beautifully elucidated in that encyclical. "They've had laryngitis on the moral teaching of the church," he told the Wall Street Journal on March 30, 2012, when he was president of the USCCB. "So much for the greater respect and understanding of the fundamental truths of the Catholic faith. We seem to be suffering from a black hole plague. After all, intellectual chaos is contagious. And the Washington swamp is not alone. Consider how America's intellectual life has deteriorated. Our culture has suffered through 3 generations of increased illiteracy, widespread moral degeneration, and the destruction of our past by Big Brothers, Ministry of Truth and his ministers, and so many of our once revered institutions. The chaos and rot extends far beyond our hierarchy. Note, not our church. The church is unassailable. It's the mystical body of Christ. One wonders what institution has been spared. Our entire federal government swarms with corruption and malfeasance. The FBI used to be sacrosanct. The IRS was once believed to be carefully objective. The Department of Justice once stood far above the country's chattering partisans. Both branches of Congress have now abdicated their constitutional responsibilities to an unelected and deep, permanent state. Abortion extremists have made the courts a war zone. Hollywood, the media, entertainment, even football are now oozing with rot. The notion of patriotism has been hijacked to mean love of the military-industrial complex. Civic responsibility, even the notion of citizen itself, is under siege. Can a people thus besieged suddenly arm itself morally and intellectually in a community sharing a common good? Oh, wait, a people? That's offensive. We pride ourselves in our diversity. Peoples, peoples. Sorry, folks, that will not last. As Russell Kirk once made clear, when faced with the choice between chaos and order, the masses will always choose order, even if you have to break a few eggs. Donoso Cortes, a noble Catholic Spaniard who died in 1853, put it this way. There comes a time when a people must choose, Christ or Barabbas. This has been PRI Review from pop.org. Thanks for listening.